station of buried alive torture in America. You are listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. For those of you just tuning in, this is
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program Taking Aim is broadcast normally at 5 p.m. every Tuesday on WBAI and over the internet at www.wbai.org. If you haven't, I strongly advise you to check out the internet. There's an incredible newsletter, and the internet is also a wonderful link to other websites that'll be of interest to you. www.wbai.org. Buried Alive, Torture in America is our premium, our gift to you for your contribution to WBAI of $125. The phone number to call is 212-209-2950. And our engineer today, Dred Scott Keyes. And Dred, if you could play the first two tracks of the second CD, and then we'll be back with you again.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, January 13th, 2004. I have been a human rights advocate on behalf of prisoners in the United States for the past 26 years, writes Bonnie Kerness, coordinator of Prison Watch for the American Friends Service Committee. We dedicated our program, Buried Alive, Torture in America, Part 1, last week to Bonnie Kerness and to Tafalwa Balogun, a prisoner in the New Jersey system. This week, we continue with Torture in America. As Bonnie writes, those years, those 26 years, have brought hundreds of increasingly disturbing calls and complaints from U.S. prisoners and their families. Most describe inhumane conditions, including cold, filth, callous medical care, extended isolation, sometimes lasting over a decade, harassment and brutality, vivid descriptions of four-point restraints, restraint hoods, restraint belts, restraint beds, stun grenades, stun guns, stun belts, tethers, waist and leg chains, and other devices of torture. Often prisoners report mentally ill prisoners banging their heads or screaming ceaselessly with no attention given to them other than overuse of psychotropic drugs. A social worker at Utah State Prison writes, Yoakum was directed to leave the strip cell and a urine-soaked pillow was placed over his head like a hood. He was walked, shackled, and hooded to a different cell where he was placed in a device called the chair. He was kept in the chair for over 30 hours, resulting in extreme physical and emotional suffering. Again from Utah, I was sprayed, writes a prisoner, with pepper spray, and it was 10 hours before I was allowed to wash. This resulted in burns and blisters to my arms, face, chest, and feet. For the entire 10 hours, I felt like I was being boiled alive. When you are forced to stand in the sun with no shelter, the sweat from your body continues to reactivate this chemical agent, so you remain in physical pain. Some of the most poignant letters, writes Bonnie, are on behalf of the mentally ill prisoners, like a man in California who spread feces over his body. The guard's response was to put him in a bath so hot it boiled 30% of the skin off his body. Or the letters I received on behalf of Frank Hunter, a mentally ill prisoner in a New Jersey isolation unit who was tortured to death. The guards would make Frank perform sexual acts on himself in order to get food or cigarettes. The use of extended isolation, which we discussed in great detail in Torture in America Part 1, has been a growing concern. In New Jersey, Ohori Lutalo has been held in the Management Control Unit in total isolation since February 4, 1986. He never received any charges or explanation for this. Sensory deprivation, isolation, enough to drive people crazy. This is Torture in America. This and other brutality are our discussion of today.
One of the most extraordinary things about this material is that it is so elaborated, so extensive, so enormous in its reach across the United States in the prisons that populate our states from one end of this country to the other, that we're overwhelmed by the enormity of the material itself. We could spend the entire day just discussing the enormity of mental torture in lockdown. The restraints, as you indicate, the four-point chairs, the devil's chair, the torture and the experiments, the prison rape, the systematic violation of women and children. We have 2 hours to convey what would take months to communicate adequately, and here it is in the summary in the statement of Ohori Nurlutaro. How does one go about articulating desperation to another who is not desperate? How does one go about articulating the psychological stress of knowing that people are waiting for me to self-destruct? Picture living in a cage the size of your bathroom, tiers of single cages above and to either side. You remain in this cage 24 hours a day, day in and day out, year in and year out. As Bonnie Kernes writes, Rochelle McGee lived under these conditions in California for more than 20 years. Russell Schultz has been living in various Pennsylvania isolation units for 17 years. Ohori Lutaro in the Management Control Unit, MCU, in Trenton began his 13th year in extended isolation, has never been charged with an infraction. In 1972, the first official control unit was opened in Marion Federal Prison in Illinois as a behavior modification experimental unit. It was designed to torture people. It was intended to test the limits to which people could be subjected before breakdown occurred. It was nothing other than an experiment in torture, which has now become the systematic and systematized method of imprisoning people in this country. Sensory deprivation as a form of behavior modification was used in particular for political prisoners. It was begun with the Black Panther Party members, the Black Liberation Army formations, the American Indian Movement, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement. It was designed for activists, jailhouse lawyers, Islamic militants, prison activists. At one time or another, they have all found themselves living in extended isolation for years on end. Political prisoners still live in isolation, not because they've received a single charge or infraction, but because of who they are and what they believe. As Bonnie Kernes explains, the experiment, so-called, in solitary confinement has expanded throughout this country through the supermax prisons, the entire prisons that force people to live in this complete isolation for years and decades. You do not see or hear another human being. The fastest growing population living in enforced solitude is youth of color, imprisoned as the result of racist laws. These youngsters receive long, unconscionable sentences, and they are then led into this super max prison system of sensory deprivation for years and even decades.
An important article appeared in the National Catholic Reporter by Claire Schaefer Duffy, December 8, 2000, and it's available on the internet at www.findarticles.com. She cites Chase Rivland. Now, Chase Rivland is important to listen to. He's a former director of two state departments of correction, and he wrote an overview of supermax confinement for the National Institute of Corrections. And he noted that in Texas and California, where the inmate population is 150,000 per state, that's in both Texas and California, each with 150,000 prisoners, 7% of the incarcerated are in administrative segregation. And this is a twofold increase from 5 years ago, from 1995 to 2000. He states specifically, quote, if you are in some parts of Texas and you have a Spanish surname, you are going to be locked down. In May 1999, the Village Voice reported that on any given day in New York State, quote, 4,000 of the state's 71,000 prisoners were doing time in a segregated housing unit. And you can be accused, but not even convicted, and still find yourself in permanent solitary lockdown. One of the most well-known in this category, notes the National Catholic Reporter, was Wen Hong Lee. Lee, who had been accused of mishandling nuclear secrets, was kept in almost total isolation for 9 months when all but one of his 59 charges were dropped. Total isolation. Let's look at Pelican Bay State Prison in California. Pelican Bay, sprawled over 275 acres just south of the Oregon border, in a Tolkien-esque region of misty mountains and ancient redwood forests. But deep in Pelican Bay, deep in this prison that holds 1,200 prisoners, there is a security housing unit where there are no jobs, no activities, hardly any educational programs, and barely any human contact. As written by Vince Beisler in a special to the Times, October 19, 2003, quote, "You are locked in your 8-by-10-foot cell, almost around the clock. You can't see the other prisoners in the cell adjoining yours, nor the guards watching from a central observation booth. Most of the time, all you can see through the fingertip-sized perforations in your cell's solid steel door is the wall of the 8-cell pod, the larger cage containing your cage. Guards deliver your meals once a day. The remote-controlled cell door grinds open, and you get 90 minutes to spend alone in a walled-in courtyard, a place more like the bottom of a mine shaft than an exercise yard. It's an environment almost as restrictive and monotonous as human minds can design, and perhaps as human minds can tolerate."
Torture in Our Midst is the description and the title of the study by Bernice Powell Johnson on June 5th of 2000 of what are called special housing units. And what we have to note here is that the Supermax prison and the control units and the administrative segregation, these are variations on a theme in every permutation and form, isolation and mental destruction through torture of this nature has been the norm and the resort to which prison authorities reach for their prison and population. As Bernice Powell Jackson describes it, 24,400 inmates across the U.S. officially, with many more multiples unofficially, locked down 23 hours a day for years. Life in SHUs is nothing like any of us can imagine. The cells, 7 feet by 8 feet, contain a bed, a sink, a toilet, and she describes what we have been recounting. If anything more gruesome, the prisoner never sees another human being. The guards control how long lights are on through video cameras, and microphones monitor every move and every physical response. State and federal courts have upheld the constitutionality of these prison units. Amnesty International have called it cruel and unusual punishment. Angela Wright, an Amnesty official, says this falls explicitly under the international standard of torture. Even former prison officials, as you cited, Chase Rivlin, former secretary of the Washington State Department of Corrections, have stated, "You put these young men, overwhelmingly black and Hispanic, into these conditions in solitary, any rehabilitation, even survival, is hopeless." They are regressing. They are regressing into subhuman conditions without any human contact. We're turning these people into zombies.
Let's look at how people survive, how they survive this isolation, this numbing isolation. Or as Stuart Grassian, the renowned psychiatrist at the Harvard Medical School, who has studied the conditions of supermax prisons, who has said the absolute total monotony, absolutely nothing coming in from the outside. And what happens then is psychological disintegration.
Let me just make this point, because before we discuss survival, let's be clear about what we're describing here. It's not only Stuart Grassian, but as the reports by Human Rights Watch establish, it is designed to, quote, manufacture madness. It is well established. This magnitude of isolation and sensory deprivation cause a variety of psychiatric symptoms and physiological and mental breakdown. Prolonged isolation brings about depression, despair, anxiety, rage, claustrophobia, hallucinations, problems with impulse control, and a total breakdown of the ability to think, concentrate or remember. These conditions are designed for mental breakdown. They are designed for psychic torture. They are unspeakable in their degree, their extent, and their non-ending, decades-long subjugation of people to the total despair of such living conditions.
They are becoming more pervasive. The prisons that are being built today are super max prisons, and they are more costly to run. $60,000 per prisoner, super max costs, because of the continual surveillance, the high-tech, intensive, labor-intensive monitoring of torture. Let's look at how people survive. It's very important. This is a manual produced by the American Friends Service Committee in November 1997. It's a manual written by and for people living in control units, and it is a testament to their willpower, their strength, and their perseverance. Paul Redd writes, "I now have been in prison 20 years, and 18 of them have been spent in various SHUs, the security housing units, the holes, from DVI, Folsom State Prison, San Quentin, and then to more high-tech isolation chambers at Corcoran State Prison and Pelican State Prison since 1990. I have many years of experience in these hell holes and have witnessed a great deal in terms of seeing individuals giving up their inner strength and beliefs because in their minds they could no longer deal with mental torture, isolation, the materialistic restrictions. These individuals gave up and broke themselves because they were missing the key essentials to their inner consciousness that give them the power to survive isolation. I have been asked over the years, how have you been able to survive all this and still be mentally intact? Before I begin sharing what I feel on some valid key points on how to survive the isolation in these dungeons, death traps, hell holes, let me state, these holes were purposefully designed as a torture chamber to break you mentally and physically into submission. Although these dungeons that our captives refer to as control units vary from state to state and prison to prison, some more isolated and restricted than others, their structure and use have the same malicious intent, and that is to control your existence and way of thinking. How do I survive? My answers are simple. 1. I know who I am and where I am going. 2. I don't let time do me, I do time. 3. My mind and thinking are far beyond the prison walls. And Paul Redd has some pointers. Among them, begin with studying your history, your culture. This will give you self-pride and respect. Think of ways that you can make positive contributions to our people. Write letters with your ideas. Keep writing. Don't stop. To family members, friends, churches, publications, radio DJs, college students, lawyers. Constantly writing reinforces your inner consciousness. Your focus is no longer your immediate isolation. Ralph?
The condition that we are describing here, that people are struggling to survive, does not only entail mental destruction. Strokes, peptic ulcers, diabetes, hypertension, salmonellosis, stomach cancer, colon cancer, kidney disease, hemorrhoids, illnesses are brought on not only by lack of diet, but by the stress and the psychic destruction of the system. Stomach cancer, colon cancer, kidney disease, these things are a constant. And so it's a question of physical, no less than it is one of mental survival. To keep oneself mentally and physically healthy through these periods of endless isolation has been a challenge for myself, as I know it has for others, writes D.A. Sheldon in Iowa. Though I'm one of those rare persons who has beaten the million-to-one odds, keeping myself extremely active, occupying loads of free time with a daily crammed schedule. I start with hour-long exercise regimen, push-ups, jumping jacks, running in place, crunches, pull-ups, chin-ups, stretching each muscle group. The most unique way I have discovered to keep the upper body in shape is by taking a pillowcase and filling it with heavy books and personal legal documents, and using the open end of the pillowcase as a handle to lift the one-half to three-quarter filled bag four different ways, lifting with each arm, then both arms in the front of the body, behind, right above the shoulder blades. It is very important in a forced sedentary lifestyle not to linger in a bunk, and to allow the destruction and the atrophy of muscles, the irregular heartbeats, the hypertension, the depressed immune system, the total atrophy of muscle groups. Even with my exercise, I am affected by these conditions after 6 years of isolation. The next thing I do is write. I draft up articles and essays, often in my mind, a poem to counter the hysteria which is dished out against the prisoner class. I talk about the conditions within Americans' dungeons, the impracticalities of the criminal so-called justice system. The activity alone takes up the majority of my time, and it brings public attention to repressive conditions here at the Iowa State Warehouse, the reality of the American prison system as a whole. I encourage you who are similarly situated, pick up an ink pen or a pencil if they're allowed. Make a habit of communicating your experience. Keep a journal, writing on anything available to you, skin or walls. I do it on a daily basis. Try to send letters to local newspapers if this is allowed. The editor may print your letter, which is reason enough for taking up the activities. I keep a busy schedule, and I seek to help others with their legal cases. I try to write to people. I try to keep in communication with others. I keep logs, books, charts, memos, kites and grievances, and storing these in order paper, and most importantly, read, if you're allowed it, especially books which further one's knowledge. And the system for survival is one of occupation, purpose, clarity about who one is, and will, above all, the human will.
These are the writings of prisoners who have survived tens of years in supermax prisons, in isolation, in the hole, in security housing units of whatever name, whether it's management control or administrative segregation or the long-term supermax conditions. The Survivor's Manual from the American Friends Service Committee. Look at it on the internet. It's a manual written by and for people living in control units. Now, also, beyond isolation, there are so many other means of torture within the prison system. According to the United Nations, in its first Congress on the Prevention of Crime and the Treatment of Prisoners, August 30th, 1955, conventions were established. They're called the Standard Minimum Rules for Treatment of Prisoners. And among them is one regarding excessive use of restraints. Quote, "Instruments of restraint, such as handcuffs, chains, irons, and straitjacket, shall never be applied as punishment. Furthermore, chains or irons shall not be used as restraint." These are the minimum standards, the rules adopted in 1955. And yet, if you look at torture in U.S. prisons, evidence of U.S. human rights violations, written by Bonnie Kerness and Masai Ehosi, and you look at the chapter on excessive use of restraints, you see over and again that the standard minimum rules are nothing but a piece of paper. Yashua M. from Northern Prison, Summers, Connecticut, on January 23, 1998, as well as on January 18th before then, and in other undated letters to the American Friends Service Committee, wrote, "In 1994, I was maced and chained because I refused to go to court without a hot meal. And as a result, he was maced, he was chained, and he writes that he knows of prisoners who are deceased as a result of being forced to cuff while having severe asthma attacks. One of these prisoners died November 3, 1997. Randy A. in Pelican Bay Prison, Crescent City, California, May 10, 1998, wrote, "I was repeatedly a victim of the stun belt, waist chains, and leg chains. One was placed around my neck and wrapped twice, and the loose ends of the neck chain were secured to my waist chains by small padlocks. I was then made to kneel down, and a second chain was looped around my ankle chains and secured to my waist chains by small padlocks. All this was done during court dates in holding cell areas."
The conditions you're describing with restraint are generalized. There isn't a prison. There isn't a holding pen. There isn't an arraignment arena in county jail before people have even been sentenced in which these techniques of restraint are not ubiquitously employed. Kevin J. in the Northern Correctional Institute in Somers, Connecticut. I've been injured multiple times, scarring, nerve problems, shoulder pain from falls. I am kept chained hand and foot, in and between and from behind, while placed outside in the courtyard by myself for hours. All this deliberate and designed to create injury. Shunwan P., Upstate Correctional Facility in Malone, New York. Corrections officers went into the cell and began reading materials. At that time, the officers told prisoners to shut up and turn around. The officers attacked the prisoners for no reason, pushing bodies and faces against the wall hard, grabbing legs out from under them, which made them fall to the ground. They were shackled, chained, cuffed, and they could not break their falls when they fell. Mike T., SCI Green, Waynesburg, Pennsylvania, on October 4th, 1999. The correction officers took my boxers, T-shirts, and socks and told us to put on jumpsuits with no underclothing. I was handcuffed and shackled, taken to a cell. I was there for 24 hours with tight handcuffs along with tight shackles. They had tape wrapping the belt, so if I tried to lay down, it would be impossible to get sleep. I asked all day if I could use the toilet. I was not allowed.
In Allred Unit, Texas, Jerry M. and James V. wrote in early 1998, I was chained to a bed sitting up for 21 days, fed one sandwich three times a day and one cup of water. I had refused to go in lockup. Guards jumped on me, grabbed me by the balls, and in a chokehold. Or Norwood N., after serving a sentence in Rahway, New Jersey, wrote in 2000 about transport. He put my hands one over the other, palms down, referring to what was done by the guard. Then he put the cuffs on me, one over the other. Then he put my arms up at high at chest level, almost under my chin. He put a so-called Chinese box device that goes between the cuffs and prevents any movement. He then took a heavy, large link chain and passed it around me almost at armpit level. I had to hold my arms up so high and avoid any wrist movement or the cuffs cut into my wrist hard. The leg irons were put on, so there was no slack to let them swivel when I walked. That's how I was required to walk and move during transport. My wrists were bloody by the time I got to the facility.
And Maya, this is a condition which is inflicted on people during prison visits with family or even with lawyers when they are rarely allowed. John Doe T., Ohio State, on January 20th, 1999. Visiting here is a punishment. The prisoner is chained to spine-stressing immobilities with arms locked in unnatural angles, forced to sit on a steel stool with no back support. It is painful. And for that reason, I've asked family to stop visiting. We are made to sit on stool without the ability to gesture with hands in conversations. Our arms and hands are twisted. And Jason in Ohio State Penitentiary states, they have a stool on one side of the petition like the ones we sit on. There is a chain that is bolted to the floor, and you sit. They sit you down on the stool, handcuffed behind your back, and then another pair of handcuffs and locks the prisoner's handcuffs and the other to the chain. It is so painful on shoulders and arms and backs you cannot move, or you will dislocate or break your wrists and shoulders. They use this chair for hearings and consultations. This is the room where I saw a committee to be released from Ohio State Prison Penitentiary. I was chained to the stool. My arms fell asleep in 5 minutes. And then there's the phenomenon known as the four-point restraint, ubiquitously used.
For the four-point restraint, let us look first again at the UN Convention, the Mini-Rule, Part 1, Items 12, 13, and 15, which state that the sanitary installations shall be adequate to enable every prisoner to comply with the needs of nature when necessary and in a clean and decent manner. Adequate bathing and shower installations shall be provided, so that every prisoner may be enabled and required to have a bath or shower at least once a week. Prisoners shall be required to keep their persons clean, and thus be provided with water and such toilet facilities as are necessary for health and cleanliness. Yet, with a four-point restraint, a prisoner is strapped down by the ankles and wrists, either to a bed or to a bare table.
M for taking aim for the WBAI fund drive. Buried Alive, Torture in America is 3 hours, 3 CDs with information about the segregation that goes on, the permanent 24-hour-a-day lockdown, separation, isolation from all living people that is prevalent in supermax prisons across the United States. The program deals with electroshock stun belts, with four-point restraint, with mace, with all the means of torture that are used not only in prisons today, but also in police departments and in rounding up people after demonstrations. Buried Alive Torture in America. For your donation of $125, your contribution, your sustaining WBAI, 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. We're going into our fourth year of taking AIM on WBAI. We couldn't do it without your support, your encouragement, and most particularly without the encouragement of the staff and management of WBAI, who depend upon you, the listeners. Remember, listeners supported WBAI, unlike any other station in the tri-state New York region. Commercial stations couldn't bring you a program such as Buried Alive, Torture in America, or Discarding the Mask, where we discuss the torture as U.S. policy, permanent policy, or any of the other programs, whether we're discussing Zionism or we're discussing the invasion and attack of Iraq or Afghanistan, what takes place here in the United States. Buried Alive, Torture in America is an example of the type of programming that we produce week in, week out for you, our supporters. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. If it's the first time you've heard us, you listen regularly to Hugh Hamilton and Talkback. We hope this gives you an idea of what we do and that you'll tune in Tuesdays at 5 p.m. regularly to hear Ralph Schoenman and myself, Maya Schoen. Meanwhile, get to your phones, 212-209-2950. Ralph?
Maya, you see, the torture that we describe is routinized and institutionalized in prisons across America, affecting now something like 6 million prisoners. And large sectors or numbers of prisoners confined in total isolation in maximum security prisons in the United States. Torture has been institutionalized. But now, an expression of the criminal nature of the state, it is being formally approved, acknowledged, and advocated. In fact, in the recent hearings to confirm Alberto Gonzalez as the Attorney General of the United States and Michael Chertoff as the replacement of Tom Ridge as head of Homeland Security, open advocacy of torture has been on the front pages of the American press. Yet during the interrogation or the nominal interrogation of these would-be nominees, there was only the most careless and casual and superficial addressing of the issue of torture, and it did not deter Republican or Democrat from supporting these people for formal office. There are, in fact, 21 million prisoners.
No,
2.1 million prisoners, but there are 6 million people affected by incarceration and by the...
Who have been imprisoned at one time or another and are U.S. citizens still alive today.
But the torture memo by Judge J.S. Bybee is discussed by John W. Dean in an important article in Find Law. And he writes, White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez has had his confirmation hearing and is on his way to becoming the new Attorney General of the United States. And in that position, he will serve as a firewall for the president. That is to say, he will be the protection for Bush against any challenge to institutionalized torture. And John Dean, who is the former Nixon administration official who had been involved in exposing Watergate. And his testimony was important in that period in what became the exposure and ultimate impeachment of Richard Nixon. The reason that Bybee's name up came up so frequently, John Dean writes, is that he signed and sent the August 1st, 2002 torture memorandum to Gonzalez. Bybee was Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel. As he ironically notes, that was an office that was once known as the conscience of the Justice Department. The memo leaked only in the summer of 2004. The document, as Dean describes it, is the most alarming bit of classified information to surface during wartime. The memorandum is far more insidious than any of the materials that we have come to note. The Bybee memo is a formal legal opinion of the Office of Legal Counsel interpreting the Convention Against Torture and the accompanying criminal provisions that had once been enacted by Congress to prohibit torture. The co-author of this memo was Bybee's deputy, John Yu, a law professor at Berkeley's Bolt Hall Law School. And here's the gravamen of this. The memo defines torture so narrowly that only activity that results in death and organ failure will qualify as torture. And only if that death is immediate. If there's subsequent death as a result of the techniques that are sanctioned here, it don't count.
Well, Ralph, as our listeners will hear, and when they acquired Buried Alive, Torture in America, this immediate death and subsequent death from the torture inflicted upon prisoners in the United States meets even the criteria that are outlined for this memo to Gonzalez, which became the standard for the memos to the president, and the basis for the president saying that the Geneva Conventions on torture wouldn't really apply to the prisoners taken in Guantanamo and in Iraq. An article appearing in the Telegraph on January 25th, Telegraph in Great Britain, mass suicide attempt at Camp Delta, brought to light what happens when people are kept in isolation and extremely degrading situations. 23 Al-Qaeda suspects tried to hang or strangle themselves at the U.S. prison camp in Guantanamo Bay during a mass protest in 2003, the Pentagon admitted yesterday. So here we have people driven to strangling themselves as the only means of getting some recognition of what their conditions were. The apparently coordinated action occurred at Camp Delta over 9 days in August 2003. The suicide attempts led to a stricter prison regime. On one day alone, August 22nd, 10 men tried to hang or strangle themselves with their clothing. Two protesters were taken to the hospital and later received psychiatric treatment. The suicide attempts came to light after they were mentioned casually during a camp visit earlier this month by three U.S. journalists, but officials issued an immediate denial. Even though there was this denial, it later on came out that these suicide attempts did take place during that period, and there were 34 suicide attempts since the camp opened in 2002.
Well, Maya, one of the aspects of this that was documented in the New York Times on January 25, 2005, an article called Detainees, ACO Presents Accusations of Serious Abuse. Abuse is a euphemism. Just listen to what they consider to be abuse. Detainees have their nose pinched while water is poured down the throat of the prisoner, wooden sticks forcefully inserted into the anus, electric shocks applied to the genitals. The practice is particularly addressed to children. One boy with a bleeding rectum described how he had been sodomized with sticks and soda bottles. These are the routinized practices that are now documented by the ACLU, acknowledged in the memoranda of those who are going to be nominated to such offices, the Attorney General of the United States and the head of Homeland Security. And here is a description in the New England Journal of Medicine. When doctors go to war, co-authored by Dr. M. Greg Bloch, professor of law at Georgetown University, and Jonathan Marks, a British barrister and fellow at the Georgetown University Law Center. And what they describe is that the doctors who are in these prisons have colluded and collaborated and actually have participated in designing what are called horrific abuses, brought to light by soldiers' photographs and reports by military intelligence officers. The doctors have directly participated in this torture. And indeed, the role of these doctors has been to bring in medical reports after the fact to disguise what has been done to the victims. Environmental manipulation, lowering heat, sleep deprivation, sensory deprivation, prolonged isolation, stress positions, the working of dogs, the use of electrical shock, the use of needles under the nails, the use of waterboarding and subjecting prisoners to conditions where they are nearly drowned, burying people alive and barely resuscitating them after they've lost consciousness. The New England Journal of Medicine report describes evidence that the United States military is enlisting the services of doctors specifically to supervise the, quote, criminal abuse and torture of detainees in practices reminiscent of the crimes carried out by Dr. Joseph Mengele of the Nazis, the infamous doctor at the Auschwitz death camp, quote, unquote.
212-209-2950, Buried Alive Torture in America. Today we're discussing both the torture in Iraq and in Guantanamo. The Buried Alive discusses the United States and conditions as horrendous, worse even, than what we have seen going on at Guantanamo and in what's been reported by Abu Ghraib. Let's look at something that is discussed in great detail in Buried Alive Torture in America. And I want to remind you again, 212-209-2950. July 28, 1999, an article again in the British public, in The Guardian. This is the U.S. Guardian. Stun Belts, Cruel and Unusual Punishment by Julia Lutsky. And she wrote this article on the basis of devastating reports from Amnesty International on the widespread use by prison authorities in the United States of restraints in the forms of handcuffs, chains, and now stun belts. And the stun belt, there was a report, first issued June 1996, called Cruelty in Control, the Stun Belt and Other Electroshock Equipment in Law Enforcement. Now, the stun belt is officially called the Remote Electronically Activated Control Technology, REACT belt. It's made by StunTech of Cleveland, Ohio. And there's also the Remote Actively Custody Control, the RACC belt, that's made by Nova Products of Cookeville, Tennessee. The stun belts are used in more than 30 states. And correctional facilities in 20 states use the stun belt. Now, this is a report from 1999. Here we are in 2005, and probably many more states are using stun belts. Let's look at what a stun belt is. As the Amnesty International report states, quote, the belt inflicts a 50,000, I repeat, 50,000 volt shock that enters the prisoner's left kidney region and travels along nerve pathways. Each pulse gives rise to a rapid shock extending throughout the body, causing severe pain and instant incapacitation. It is designed for the total psychological supremacy, and the infliction of pain. If you were wearing a contraption around that waist, according to StunTech, the manufacturer, by the mere push of a button, they warn that you would go into uncontrollable spasm and be completely incapacitated. 50,000 volts. Now, the U.S. Department, the Consumer Protection Safety Commission, noted that deaths have been caused by the stun belt and stun guns. According to one forensic pathologist, 9 individuals who were alive and active collapsed on tasering. Taser is another name for the stun belt, and did not survive. In my opinion, writes the pathologist, the taser contributed directly to these 9 deaths, and he gave the reason. A device capable of depolarizing skeletal muscle also depolarizes heart muscle and causes fibrillation. 50,000 volts.
50,000 volts, which are beyond human tolerance that you described, are the procedures that have been authorized and deployed routinely not only against prisoners, but against people who have not yet been convicted of any crime, but who are held in pretrial situations and even imposed on people who are prisoners before the dock. They are wired up, and if they stand up, or if they move too suddenly, or if they attempt to speak on their own behalf without authorization from the bench, they can be subject and have been subject to this kind of electric shock treatment that throws them into spasm and unconsciousness. It is so grotesque, and yet it is so routine, and it is so hidden, I should put it differently, it is not so much that it is hidden, it's that it goes unremarked upon. The New York Times had published an article in which the author, Mark Danner, on January 6th, set forth what we are describing here under the headline, "We Are All Torturers Now." And during the hearings before the Congress concerning the nomination of Alberto Gonzalez, as I have mentioned, as Attorney General of the United States, it was acknowledged that it was not only Gonzalez and Professor John Yoo and Michael Chertoff, major figures in the Bush administration with the support of Congress, prepared the series of documents formally authorizing the Bush administration to abandon the Geneva Convention and to make torture an official policy of the United States. The documentation and the exposure of these practices behind prison walls that have been routinized across the United States in prisons over decades is what this series has been about. We have been there, we have been documenting it, and we ask you to support this kind of broadcasting and to avail yourself of the documentation and the information in order to better arm us politically, ideologically, intellectually, to fight back, to expose, and to mobilize our people against the torture state that is the government of this country today.
212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. For those of you listening on the internet, this is your only opportunity for Buried Alive, Torture in America. You must get on the telephone right now. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. This is the WBAI pledge room telephone number. There are many people in there waiting to hear from you, and they can discuss Buried Alive, Torture in America, our premium for you, our gift, $125 contribution, and there are other ways to become members of WBAI. Your credit card, your debit card, cash or check, 212-209-2950. Become a sustainer of WBAI. For those of you who are able, think about now making your contribution of $500, $1,000, $10,000 or more to keep WBAI on the air during these very important times. If WBAI were off the air, you would have there would be a vacuum created. You wouldn't know where to turn for the information that helps with the analysis, for the understanding, and for organizing the opposition to this torture state.
And actually, I have to say that it is a kind of moral obligation we all have, if to do no more else than to make public, to place on record, to allow the surfacing and the airing of this reality, which the official press and the propaganda instruments of the state that work through the corporate media are forever engaging in suppressing and disguising and in routinizing through denial. It's important for us, brothers and sisters, to keep this truth alive and available to all of us, and that's the importance then of supporting a radio station that is based upon public support, committed to free speech, and prepared to challenge the official orthodoxy of the moment.
212-209-2950. Our engineer this time is Paul Ryan, and Paul, we'd like to go and play a small excerpt of the third CD of this three CD set.
Well, Maya, the Angel Fire website, which is a mine of documentation about the prison industrial complex and the what is in essence a plantation and slave system, has the following observation. Prisons are now abundantly run by private companies that have the majority of the prisoners in the United States under their control. The major computer companies are Microsoft, Dell, IBM, Compaq, Motorola, Texas Instruments, Nortel, Lucent Technologies, AT&T Wireless, Bay Networks, 3Com, IBM, Intel, Northern Telecom, Digital Switch, New Bridge Networks, to cite only the most prominent. Now, what we are describing here is the very heart of corporate capital in the United States, for which the prisons are an ocean of supply for slave labor. The wages of the labor, the report continues, makes the use of this labor extraordinarily attractive for all types of business. The Wackenhut Corporation has a huge portion of private-run portion of the prison market, and the documentation pertaining to the ubiquitous use of labor in prisons by the heart of American corporate production is pervasive.
Ralph, an article called "The Use of Prison Labor in the Computer Market," that's also available on Angel Fire, notes that EXMARK, packages and shrinks wraps many products for Microsoft. Many Microsoft products are packaged and shrink wrapped by prisoners at Washington State's Twin Rivers Correction Center, TRCC, according to Dan Penz, who's co-editor of the Prison Legal News and a prisoner at TRCC. Penz tells NewsBytes, which then reported it on AngelFire.com, that Exmark, which is a company specializing in product packaging and located in Monroe, Washington, and is a subsidiary of PAC Services, used the services of 90 prisoners at TRCC to package 50,000 units of Windows 95 demo disks and direct mail promotional packets. And then they also packaged tens of thousands of units of Microsoft Office, other software, and hundreds of thousands of Microsoft mice. Exmark pays its prisoners the minimum wage of $4.90 an hour in Washington, but the figure is misleading. After deductions by the prisoners, prisoners see a spendable wage of $1.80 to $2.80 per hour. But the law then authorizes up to 80% of the prisoners' wages to be deducted, meaning that they actually take home less than $1 an hour. And that's actually high. In many institutions, it comes down to 20 cents an hour.
About 21 cents an hour is what they are paying prisoners in these slave wage circumstances. And one has to keep in mind when you talk about the 21 cents an hour that prisoners are then obliged to forfeit a substantial portion of their munificent pay to the institution itself.
And also to pay for their hygiene items like toothpaste, soap, and extra toilet paper, and also to buy all their other needs, such as their clothing.
And when they buy from the prison by force or by obligation, there's a 30% surcharge on top of it all for the privilege of buying from the prison institution itself.
For the so-called victim restitution fund. Now, Exmark, Ralph, which packages for Microsoft, also packages for other companies using prison labor, such as JanSport, Starbucks, U.S. West, and Costco. And this was reported in 1997. Ralph?
Look for That Prison Label is the title of the article by Julie Light in The Progressive in June 2000. The assembly lines at CMT Blues look like those at any other U.S. garment factory. Workers hunch over industrial sewing machines, intently stitching T-shirts. But unlike most garment workers, however all of these are made, there's an even bigger difference because armed guards patrol the shop floor. CMT Blues is housed at the maximum security Richard J. Donovan State Correctional Facility outside of San Diego, California. It is part of California's growing joint venture programs that links companies to all state prisons. Workers are sewing T-shirts for Mecca, Seattle Cotton Works, Lee Jeans, No Fear, Trinidad Tees, and many other U.S. companies. The highly prized jobs pay far less than minimum wage, but less than half of the small amounts they receive find their way into inmates' pockets. The rest is siphoned off to the state, nominally for the cost of incarceration. The inmates, their families, and their dependents receive vanishingly little. The California Department of Corrections and CMT Blues owner Pierre Simon says they are providing inmates with job skills and their work ethic. But inmates who work for CMT Blues state Simon and the Department of Corrections are operating a slave labor sweatshop behind bars. What's more, the inmates state prison officials retaliate against them when they blew the whistle on what was corrupt. They claim was corruption at the plant. The prisoners state they were forced to replace made in Honduras labels with made in USA tags to defraud consumers. And they were not paid minimum wages at all or paid on time or paid at all for their first months of work. CMT Blues is the tip of the iceberg.
Ralph, in 1990, there was a ballot initiative. California has an initiative process where the people of California, as well as the legislature, can change the Constitution and create laws. And in 1990, there was a ballot initiative that created the Joint Venture Program. And CMT Blues is operating under that joint venture program with the California Department of Contracts. And CMT Blues happens to be the largest contractor in this joint venture program. Now, there's a benefit to...
You've been listening to a small excerpt of the third CD of Buried Alive Torture in America. And the third CD, we discuss slave labor, the treatment of children in prisons across America, and the... abominable treatment of women in prisons. Buried Alive Torture in America, the Taking Aim premium for the your donation during the WBAI fund drive, 212-209-2950, three CDs, your $125 contribution. This is a series that you're going to want everyone you know to listen to. We've been hearing that whoever has heard the program is amazed, is shocked. They said they thought they knew what was going on in the prisons, but the veil has been lifted, and this it puts it all into perspective. 212-209-2950. Ralph, before we go on to the 5 o'clock hour...
Well, Maya, you know... we are describing in this three-part series on the routinized torture and torment of prisoners across the United States what is essentially an institutional form of torture. And the reality of that for decades has not been acknowledged. Only now has the state apparatus embraced torture with open acknowledgement and welcome. And that has enormous implications for us because... in a certain sense, all of us are responsible for a conspiracy of silence. We have taken note of the fact, all of us, that there are extreme measures and torture and torment inflicted upon the prison population. But somehow, in our own minds, we've constructed a wall of separation between those who are routinely put behind bars, and it's really the criminalization of poverty and the war on black America that we're describing here. And somehow we've taken a distance from that, or taken it as some sort of exceptionalism without an understanding that this is the class war for which we are all targeted. The New York Times on January 9th published a guide to the memos on torture. This was reported also in Newsweek, The Washington